This is Heroes of the 500. I'm Steve Simpson. Year after year, families pack the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, many holding the same seats for decades. Over the years, those family bonds have strengthened the traditions of the greatest spectacle in racing. It's true that in more than 200,000 permanent seats ringing the oval, and it's also true in the fastest 33 seats in sports, the starting grid for the Indianapolis 500. Over the years, many famous families have made their mark, with father and son combinations, brother acts, and even uncles and nephews taking to the world's most famous race course. Over the next 2 hours, we'll look back at the great families of the 500, from a famous family that has 9 BorgWarner trophies to those tinged with tragedy. But we start our look at the famous families of the Indianapolis 500, with one that has seen its share of rotten luck. At 16th and Georgetown.
Mario Andretti slowing down on the main straightaway and a crash in turn four, Bob.
Yes, it involves Mario Andretti.
Michael Andretti, the leader, is slowing down, coming down the back straightaway. Oh, my goodness.
The Andretti family has participated in 68 Indianapolis 500s, leading 27 times for 1,110 laps. But despite that dominance, they still just have one BorgWarner trophy. When the Andretti dynasty started, it certainly seemed like plenty of space would be needed for the family's Indianapolis hardware. Mario and twin brother Aldo emigrated to the United States from Italy in 1955. They had both dreamed of becoming Formula One stars in Europe, so the trip to America wasn't something they were excited about until they heard the sounds coming from the local fairgrounds in their new home, Nazareth, Pennsylvania. Mario explained his excitement to Mark Monteith on One-on-One.
We're living with our uncle. You know, we stayed in their home for about 2 weeks. And all of a sudden, in just in the background, about, say, a mile and a half away or so, we see lights on a Sunday night. Lights, and we hear a roar. And Aldo and I looked at each other and says, wow, you know. So we booked. We just followed the sound, and we just ran over, and this was the fairground, local Nazareth Fairgrounds, and they had these modified stock car races, which were on a Sunday night. And we just peeked through, you know, the slots and the fence and so forth, and we see these brute cars. It looks so odd because, you know, for us, you know, what we had imagined was Formula One, you know, there was still, you know, more sophistication. But, you know, we looked at that and says, man, you know, this is doable.
A serious crash would rob Aldo Andretti of a chance at a big-time career. But Mario moved from the local stock car scene onto sprint car glory before landing a full-time ride in Indy cars for the 1965 season.
I've been dreaming about coming to this place since I was 13 years old back in Italy. That's when I started racing. And, well, now I'm here, and it certainly is a realization of a dream, and I'm qualified. Now, come race day, I'll be looking for the short way around.
Mario became an overnight sensation in 1965 and won Rookie of the Year honors with a third-place finish. He followed that up with back-to-back pole positions in 1966 and 67, but dropped out early both years. It got even worse in 1968, when Andretti started fourth and finished last. In 1969, Andretti thought he had the car to beat, but a practice crash destroyed his new Lotus. The team switched to a backup, Bronner Hawk, and despite concerns that the engine would last due to overheating, the superstar finally had the one he wanted.
Ronnie's in my sights, and what a beautiful sight it is, and what a competent guy. The people up here are applauding, and a happy crew we know. And here is Sid Cullen.
And here's the checkered flag. Pat Vidan holds it and waves it for Mario Andretti, winner of the 1969 500-mile race.
But the 1969 win would be the last time Andretti would complete the distance until 1981.
They brought him into the pit area immediately. They went to the top of the engine. They took the plugs out. Andretti is out of the car. Of course, the car is being moved away. So something mechanically is given away on the inside, and Andretti appears to be through for the day.
It's Mario Andretti in car number 21. Now, it appeared that the car bolted out of its position. We have the binoculars on the car right now, and Andretti is out of the car. But the car spun toward the top of the back stretch. Then he appeared to hit the inside wall coming across the grassy infield there.
Andretti thought he had a second win in 1981. He was awarded the trophy the day after the race, after winner Bobby Unser was found to have violated a blend line rule. But later that year, an appeals panel restored Unser's win and moved Andretti back to second. The 1981 win was a precursor to another series of near misses and disappointments for Andretti.
The field rolling toward the line. No green flag is out. Rick Mears moved ahead on the start. We've got an accident on the main straightaway. Kevin Cogan is against the wall.
I got him, and it is Danny Sullivan gets him. Danny Sullivan gets him. No, he's squirrely. No, he's spinning. Danny Sullivan spins, but he goes around twice and gathers it in.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti, gathered the car back up and continues on, and Sullivan only fell back to second place.
Perhaps the toughest loss of all came in 1987, when Andretti dominated the 500 from the pole, leading 170 of 180 laps he was on the track, before dropping out with ignition trouble while holding a massive lead.
Mario Andretti slowing down on the main straightaway, and this could be the question answered. Number five, slow on the main stretch, and Roberto Guerrero goes into the lead. Mario Andretti slows down.
By the time Andretti had seen victory snatched away in 1987, a second generation had joined the field, with Mario's son Michael establishing himself as a contender. The younger Andretti scored top 10 finishes in his first three 500s. Michael Andretti led in 1986 and 89, but he dropped out moments after grabbing the lead from eventual winner Emerson Fittipaldi.
And we've got Michael Andretti slowing down. You guys see it at the south end?
I've got it right here. It's the crowd just came up in a big roar. He's down below the white line. There's smoke coming out of the rear of the automobile.
In 1991, the younger Andretti had race leader Rick Mears in his sights with less than 20 laps to go, looking for the knockout punch. The veteran Mears would have other ideas.
Michael Andretti through four running smooth. Rick Mears trying to reel him in. Coming down low, they head to the main straightaway, but it is still Michael Andretti and Rick Mears with a head toward turn one and Jerry Baker.
Former co-rookie of the year, Michael Andretti. Now Mears goes to the outside and Rick may have him. They move into the short shoot. Rick Mears takes the lead.
Rick Mears becomes the third four-time winner of the Indianapolis 500, winning the Diamond Jubilee Edition, the 75th running of this great speed classic.
But it was perhaps 1992 that truly sums up the Andretti's struggle to conquer the Brickyard. On that bitterly cold day, four Andrettis would take the green flag, with Mario's younger son Jeff having made his Speedway debut the previous year, and John Andretti, the son of Mario's twin brother Aldo, established as a Speedway veteran. On lap one, the Andretti serve noticed that this would be their day, with Michael and Mario electrifying the crowd with a dramatic move on Eddie Cheever.
And the green flag is out, the race is on, and Eddie Cheever jumps into the lead as they head for one.
Eddie Cheever takes the lead, and Michael Grant, oh, Michael passed him on the inside. Michael Andretti in the short shootout front with Mario right behind.
Mario led one lap, but 78 laps in, the veteran was caught up in a hard crash that would send him to Methodist Hospital with broken toes.
And a crash in turn four, Bob.
Yes, it involves Mario Andretti and some good driving by Buddy Lazier to get by. Same with Dominic Dobson. Again, spin coming off four. Mario makes contact into the wall, virtually the same spot that Tom Sneva did. He slides to a stop in the area headed to the pits, but about halfway between turn four and the pit area. The first vehicle right to him. Mario's still in the car. The guy's talking to him right now. And checking around to make sure. It looks like some heavy damage on the left side of the car, Bob.
While doctors tended to Mario, Michael simply dominated the race. But another cruel twist was coming.
Another crash in turn number two.
Jeff Andretti came through two, out of shape, a half spin, another car involved to the inside. Gary Bettenhausen apparently got some debris. We're over in turn two. First of all, to recapitulate, Jeff Andretti with hard contact coming off the second corner. He slides down the back straightaway. Gary Bettenhausen got involved, made contact to the inside of the wall.
Michael's younger brother Jeff crashed heavily after a wheel came off his car while entering turn two. He suffered severe leg injuries and joined his father at the hospital. Michael Andretti was still leading, but fate wasn't finished kicking the family quite yet.
And the pace is about 221 miles an hour, and Larry, is he slowing down?
Michael Andretti, the leader, is slowing down, coming down the back straightaway. Oh, my goodness. Michael Andretti going slowly, heading down to the inside. Unbelievable. Michael Andretti, the engine, we can barely hear it. Michael Andretti, your leader that's dominated, is slowing down. That'll put Al Unser Jr. Jr. into the lead.
With 11 laps to go, Andretti dropped out with a fuel pump failure after leading 160 laps. John Andretti would end up eighth, his second of four straight top 10 finishes. But race day 1992 will always be a dark day for the Andrettis. Due to a one-year run in Formula One and the open wheel split, Michael Andretti would only run the 500 twice in the next 8 years. He returned in 2001 for a three-year run before apparently retiring after the 2003 500. But in 2006, Michael Andretti was back for the opportunity to race with his son, just as his father Mario had done. Marco Andretti was a 19-year-old that wasn't expected to win as a teenager, since no driver in the race's history had done so. Michael Andretti wasn't expected to win either, but after a late caution with four laps to go, the elder Andretti found himself in first place, with son Marco second.
Down the front straight, the Vonage car in front, and he's going to take the lead into turn number one with Andretti green cars around him.
Michael Andretti, but now Marco's got to work his way around Brian Herta if he wants to get to his dad. Michael Andretti heads the field into turn two.
And the man on the move is going to be Sam Hornish Jr. He gets around the lap machine of Max Pappas. He now rides fourth in line, continuing to lead, though. Michael Andretti to turn three.
Michael Andretti gets to turn three first. Marco Andretti works his way around Brian Herta. He's going to try to reel in dad already in the short queue in the north end.
It is one and two, dad and son, Michael and Marco Andretti. Marco goes low, about four car lengths behind his dad, Michael Andretti.
Three laps will remain for Michael Andretti. 7.5 miles to realize the dream. Here goes Marco Andretti, side by side.
Oh,
he's going to make the pass to the wall.
Marco Andretti has passed his dad, Michael. Marco leads the field into the southeast corner.
Hey, dad, watch this. Marco Andretti to the inside, and now Michael going to lose the second position. Sam Hornish Jr. pulls up alongside. They're battling for the runner-up spot to turn three.
Michael pedaling for all it's worth, trying to hold on to second. Not going to be able to do it. Hornish stepped in front of him. Meanwhile, Marco roars away on the north end.
19-year-old Marco Andretti exiting turn four. The fans on their feet. He's got a 15-car length lead over Sam Hornish Jr.
The third generation of the Andretti family to race here at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Two laps away from a win in turn number one.
Here comes Sam, though. He is closing up on Marco Andretti, about 5 or 6 car lengths back into turn two.
You can visually see him closing the gap. Sam Hornish Jr. has battled adversity throughout the day. He's trying to get the lead at Indy. He pulls up on the rear wing of Marco Andretti.
Nobody has seen it. Fans on their feet. Hornish all over Marco Andretti. Almost goes into the pit lane. Marco slams the door, holds the lead by 5 car lengths.
Marco Andretti in the short chute. That lead is about 10 car lengths over Sam Hornish Jr. He's down the front straightaway, trying to get the win.
The white flag is out at the world's greatest race course. 19-year-old Marco Andretti, now less than 2 miles away from winning the 90th Indianapolis 500.
Four more left-hand turns, and Marco Andretti has stretched the lead. He heads into the second corner.
What a headline it's going to make. Marco Andretti wins in his debut in Indianapolis. He has a 7-car length advantage midway down the backstretch for the final time.
Coming up on the scene in which he may have won the race last time by, they're waving bandanas, waving hats. Cut the left tank for racing immortality for 19-year-old Marco Andretti.
And Sam Hornish Jr. right on the tail of Marco Andretti. Can a teenager win in Indianapolis?
Here's the finish. Sam Hornish Jr. makes the pass. He'll win it. Sam Hornish Jr. goes to the inside of Marco Andretti and wins it in the final 100 yards. Sam Hornish Jr. has won the 90th Indianapolis 500 in an incredible finish. Perhaps one of the closest finishes in history at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. 63 thousandths of a second as Sam Hornish Jr. has beaten Marco Andretti.
What looked like it would end as a 1-2 finish for father-son instead finished with another Andretti disappointment.
I don't know. There goes, I guess, the Andretti luck, because second's nothing here.
Marco Andretti has gone on to lead 6 of his 8 500 starts, but is still looking for the win that has eluded the family since 1969. Coming up next, while the Andretti family has hit snake eyes for the most part at the Brickyard, another famous family has seen tragedy and plenty of triumph. This is Heroes of the 500. This is the Heroes of the 500, the Family Ties edition. I'm Steve Simpson. We continue our look at famous families of the Brickyard with one that has been tinged by tragedy and triumphed more than any in history. The Unser family actually made their debut at Indianapolis way back in 1940 when Louis Unser started on a rookie test at the Brickyard. But Unser didn't finish the test and never qualified for the greatest spectacle in racing. But the family wasn't finished at IMS by a long shot. More than a decade later, Louis Unser's nephew, Jerry, who, like his uncle, was an ace of the Pikes Peak Hill Climb, came to Indianapolis to start on his rookie test. He passed on his very first try in 1958 and qualified 24th. Unfortunately, Jerry Unser never even competed a lap in his first and only 500.
We've got an accident here. Car number five, the Zinc Special, is the first to wreck. Another over the wall. And we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 cars piled up here on the northeast turn. The 54 Novi into the infield. Car number 19 in the infield. 68 now down into the infield. And it's almost impossible to identify the others. Out of car number five now, it's Ed Elysian. And car number 91 against the wall. That is all that we can see at the moment. Further down. Down the track, there are still others. One car has left this track, Sid.
That car that left the track was Jerry Unser, who went over the wall. The rookie suffered a dislocated shoulder in the crash. The next year, Unser was back, but on May 2nd, he was badly injured in a practice crash that left him critical with burns. Just over 2 weeks later, Unser died from his injuries. He was just 26 years old.
The day before Jerry died, he's talking about, he didn't know how bad he was burned. And to tell you the truth, we didn't either. I mean, what do you really know about doctor work, you know? He's laying in the bed and we're talking, and he's talking about me coming back to Indianapolis that he thinks he's got a car that I could take my driver's test in. That's how Jerry passed away. Was thinking about things like that. He wasn't laying, well, we didn't know he was on his deathbed, but he wasn't laying there feeling sorry for himself. He was just laying there thinking Bobby needs to get going and get back there because Jerry thought that he had a car that I could get my test in.
The tragedy would not keep the Unser family away from the world's greatest race course. 4 years later, Jerry's younger brother Bobby would come to the Speedway to try and make his debut. By 1963, Bobby Unser, like his late brother and famous uncle, was a star of the Pikes Peak Hill Climb, but he hadn't run any other races on the USAC Championship Tour. When Parnelli Jones suggested that car owner Andy Granatelli give the rookie a chance in one of his famous Novis, Granatelli is reported to have replied, "Who's Bobby Unser?" But Unser immediately was quick. And he qualified 16th for his first 500. But much like his late brother Jerry, Bobby Unser's rookie 500 was over basically before it began.
Right down in front of us, unfortunately, but out of his car and standing along the side is Bobby Unser in car number 6, the Hotel Tropicana Novi. Gas and water coming down on the track. They will have to slow down completely. Bobby gets out of the car and runs over across the track. Coming out of that turn, he spun once, hit the wall, came to rest with the nose of number 6, the bright yellow Novi, here against the wall.
After winning Pikes Peak again in 63, Bobby Unser was back in 1964. But the second year star was caught up in the second lap crash that claimed the lives of Eddie Sachs and Dave McDonald. After two starts, Unser had finishes of 33rd and 32nd.
Those were good days in my life. There wasn't any chance of my finishing the race, and I knew that. I hoped that it would finish, but the car would always go fast. And to Bobby Unser, that became the most important thing. You know, I used to have a theory that if you practiced fast, if you qualified fast and you led the races or went really fast in the races, then everybody knew you and life got a lot easier. Sponsorship, money, rides, you know, cars to drive was always a lot easier. Now, if you didn't do any of those three, you became what's known as a failure, see?
For 1965, a brother act was formed at the Brickyard as Bobby's younger brother Al arrived on the scene to start his rookie test. He passed while driving for the Arciero brothers, but it appeared the car wouldn't be fast enough to get in the race. But Al Unser would get a major break when the pole sitter and defending champion A.J. Foyt offered his backup car to the Raw rookie. Not only did Unser qualify 32nd, he ended up 9th, the first of what would be 15 top 10 finishes. In the early years of the head-to-head sibling rivalry, it was actually younger brother Al who put up the better results, including a second-place finish to his previous benefactor, Foyt, in 1967. But it would be big brother Bobby who would break through for the big prize first.
Here is a confident guy. He should be. He's almost home right now. Orange, black, and white car from Albuquerque, New Mexico. A handsome lad and a great driver, Bobby Unser. And here is Sid Collins.
The white flag now for Dan Gurney, who's going to come in second. There's the checkered flag for Bobby Unser, winner of the 1968 500-mile race.
Bobby Unser led 127 laps to take home the 1968 500, the first of what would turn out to be a parade of victories for the family. The next year, Al missed the 500 due to a motorcycle accident he actually suffered in the Speedway infield prior to qualifying. But Bobby was third to Mario Andretti. But in 1970, Al Unser had healed, and there was no stopping Johnny Lightning.
A handsome man from Albuquerque, the blue number two, and he got quite a hand up here. The crowd rose as one when he came by, and that's a great tribute to a great driver with a great car. And now here is Sid.
Al Unser, the checkered flag, the winner of the 1970 Indianapolis 500-mile race.
Al Unser simply dominated the 1970 Indianapolis 500, leading 190 of the 200 laps for Vels Parnelli Jones Racing. The next year, the team did something rarely witnessed at the Brickyard.
Blue car with a big number one, and he is number one. And now to call the winner for the 24th consecutive time is our chief announcer, the voice of the 500, Sid Collins.
And here is Pat Vidan waving the checkered flag for Al Unser, winner of the 1971 Indianapolis 500-mile race.
In 1971, Al Unser led another 103 laps and became at the time just the fourth man to win back-to-back Indianapolis 500s. 1972 saw speeds at the track jump by 17 miles an hour. Bobby Unser grabbing the pole, but dropped out early after leading the first 30 laps. Al backed up his two previous wins with a second-place finish. The family nearly grabbed another BorgWarner trophy in 1974 when Bobby finished second to winner Johnny Rutherford. But the tables were turned in 1975 when the rains came and the finishing order flip-flopped.
This race could well be stopped. In fact, there comes the rain pretty heavily. We're watching Pat Vidan. The yellow is out, and we're going to wait to make it official if he's going to pull out the red or not, which has to happen. Now it's pouring down rain. That's going to be it. And Bobby Unser from Albuquerque, New Mexico, may have weathered the storm, so to speak, and pushed himself into victory lane here by virtue of water.
Now the brothers had two BorgWarner trophies each, more than could be expected for most any career. But it only took 3 years and another dominant car for Al to break the tie.
Doing a fantastic job is Al Unser. The checkered flag is waved. His hand is in the air. Al Unser, the winner of the 1978 500-mile race.
In 1978, Al Unser led 121 laps in grabbing his third Indianapolis 500 win. And just for good measure, later that summer, he bagged 500-mile races at Pocono and Ontario as well, sweeping the Triple Crown. Al Unser almost made it two in a row and four overall the next year, as he led 85 of the first 103 laps, but he dropped out with transmission trouble, ending his day. Brother Bobby picked up the sword and seemed on his way to a third win after leading a race-high 89 laps. But with 19 laps to go, Unser slowed with gearbox trouble, handing the lead to eventual winner Rick Mears, although the veteran still hung on for a well-earned fifth-place finish. 2 years later, Bobby Unser finally grabbed that third BorgWarner trophy, but not without plenty of post-race controversy. Unser started on the pole and led a race-high 89 laps, but what should have been a routine pit stop near the three-quarter mark of the race ended up turning the 1981 Indianapolis 500 upside down. During a caution flag period, leader Mario Andretti pitted, followed closely by second-place Unser. Unser got out first, with Andretti closely behind. When the two cars got to the pace car and the rest of the field, Unser stayed on the apron and rolled past more than a dozen cars before getting into line behind the pace car. Andretti passed a couple of cars as well and then blended into line with the others. At the time, it seemed like no big deal, In fact, the Speedway Radio Network made no mention at all of the situation. But at that time, ABC Television was showing the race on a tape-delayed basis. While putting the event together in post-production for that night's broadcast, this is how it was presented.
Bobby out again, and Bobby going out very past a car. What's he doing? Look at that. He's passed about half a dozen cars.
Oh, James, that's...
Under the yellow, you can't do that.
That is a no-no. He has accelerated probably in the haste of leaving the pit lane. He's certainly overtaken these other cars. I'm not sure why he did that. I know that you're certainly not supposed to do it. The regulations say that under yellow flag conditions, you must not pass any other cars, and that certainly has been the case here. He's certainly passed other cars. Right now, of course, they're under the yellow. There you see him in the blue and red car. They have blue and yellow car.
Unser would go on to win the race, but the next day, the United States Auto Club declared that second-place finisher Andretti was now the winner, because Unser had passed cars under the yellow flag. Unser was dropped to second place, a decision Penske Racing immediately protested. The battle dragged out all summer, until finally, in October, the USAC Appeals Board voted 2-1 to reinstate the victory to Bobby Unser. The 1981 500 would turn out to be Bobby Unser's last. Coming up next, Bobby and Al each have three Indy wins, but one looks for the tiebreaker, and a new generation arrives to electrify the Brickyard faithful.
Bob Jenkins, who's going to win it?
The checkered flag is out. Goodyear makes a move. Little Al wins by just a few tenths of a second.
This is Heroes of the 500. This is the Heroes of the 500, the Family Ties Edition. I'm Steve Simpson. 1981 was Bobby Unser's final Indianapolis 500, leaving him tied with younger brother Al with three wins each at the Brickyard. But Al wasn't done, and just 2 years later, he was knocking on the door of number four. And this time, he had a little help.
Well, Little Al may be helping Dan as Tom Steva comes alongside, tries to get by Little Al, but Little Al slams the door on him. Ronnie!
He's got him. He slams him again. Tom Steva has to stay in the third place. That silver bullet is right on the tail of his dad, Al Unser Sr.
Al Unser Jr. was making his debut in the 500 in 1983, and he immediately found himself in between first place Al Sr. and second place Tom Steva. It was Al Sr.'s 44th birthday, and Al Jr. was doing his best to play jam car for his dad.
Two or three times we've seen Little Al slam the door on Tom Steva and keep him from catching his dad. I don't know whether Little Al's doing it intentionally or not, but he's doing a great job of blocking.
With 10 laps to go, Steva finally got past Al Jr. in traffic and then made quick work of the three-time winner.
They flash by us, and it's nose to tail. As Steva drops down inside on the low side, Larry, has he taken him?
I think Tom Steva's got it! Yes! Neva's in the lead. He does a move. He has to get by Chris Neifel. He goes to the low side of Neifel. He's around him in the short chute. Neva in the lead into four.
Neva would pull away for the win. Al Sr. would finish second in his first 500 for Roger Penske. Al Jr. 10th in his rookie year. Al Sr. would continue to rack up top finishes with Penske, adding a third in 1984 and a fourth the next year. Later in the 1985 season, father and son would battle for the IndyCar Championship. During the final race of the year at Miami, Jr. was leading the title chase with Sr. in second. With the laps winding down, it appeared that Little Al would grab his first title. But if Big Al could find a way past Roberto Moreno, he would grab one more point and the championship. Unser Sr. had a choice to make, stay behind Moreno and guarantee his son the title, or pass him and take the crown away from his kid.
And there comes the flag advising Moreno that Al's behind him. Big Al comes around at the edge of the flag. Now Big Al has the national championship.
Big Al did what racers do. He passed Moreno and won the title by 1 point over Little Al. Al Unser Sr. was the 1985 IndyCar champion, but with tears in his voice.
When I was catching Marino, it crossed my mind, but yet it's something that I'm just a racer.
Right.
I can't.
That's right.
I just couldn't back off.
Unser won the title, subbing for Rick Mears, who was rehabbing his injured legs from a crash the previous year. But in 1987, Big Al found himself out of a ride when the month of May began. Danny Ungayas took Unser's spot on the powerful Penske team. But Ungayas was injured in a practice crash and was not cleared to drive. Penske turned back to Big Al and grabbed a backup car from a display at a Sheraton hotel in Pennsylvania. Unser started 20th and avoided trouble all day, including a spinning Jose Legarza on lap one. Big Al continued to move up the scoring pylon, but nobody had anything for leader Mario Andretti, who dominated. Unser was nearly two laps down with 25 to go, but the veteran had worked his way up to third place, just in case anything happened to the leaders.
Mario Andretti slowing down on the main straightaway, and this could be the question answered. Number five slows on the main stretch, and Roberto Guerrero goes into the lead.
After leading all but seven of the first 177 laps, Andretti's bid for a second win was derailed by an ignition problem. Roberto Guerrero took over the lead, but he still had one critical pit stop to make.
They've disengaged. He stalls the engine. Now, back the inertial starter. It is in. Roberto Guerrero fires again. It catches quickly. Luckily, they push him off and won't catch fully. Now it does engage. Now it doesn't. A very slow pull away at the south end of the pit. Come on. It has stopped. Virtually stopped.
And Roberto Al Unser picks up the lead of the race as Guerrero stops on the pits. Al Unser picks up the race. The crowd comes to a stand. Guerrero sits silently in the pits.
With Guerrero's pit problems, Unser now held a one-lap lead. And despite a late caution, he held off the rapidly charging Colombian to join an elite group.
And history is matched as the twin checkered flags come out for our second four-time winner of the Indianapolis 500, Al Unser.
To make things even more special, Little Al finished fourth and gave his dad a big thumbs up on the cooldown lap. The Unsers now had seven wins, but the big question was, when would the talented Unser Jr. finally get his face on the BorgWarner Trophy? It appeared the sculptor would need to start work on Little Al's face just 2 years later, as Al Jr. battled Emerson Fittipaldi for the win with two laps to go.
They've got slower traffic in front of them now. Al trying to get to the outside to pass Emo right behind him. Emo moves to the outside down in front of Howdy Bell. Moved to very close to that white line. They head for three. Emo may have him, Larry.
They're side by side. Emo on the inside. Al caught in traffic. Goes high. They touch wheels. Oh. Al Jr. into the wall hard. Emerson Fittipaldi keeps on going. They touched wheels. Al Jr. into the wall, and Emerson Fittipaldi will lead them back to the yellow flag.
Fittipaldi would go on to take the checkered flag. Despite the crash, Al Jr. still ended up second, at the time his best 500 finish. After climbing from the car, Unser Jr. gave a famous thumbs up to his rival.
Al Jr. out along the side of the racetrack now. Bob Jenkins.
There was a gesture given by Al Unser Jr. as M.O. passed by on the racetrack. Al moved himself out to the white line and made some kind of a gesture too far away for me to see, but certainly some disappointment and frustration from Al Unser Jr.
But he told Mark Monteith on One-on-One that he had a much different plan at first.
When I got out of the car, it was, you know, I stood there for a minute and then I started heading towards the track. And one of the crew safety guys, he stood in front of me. He goes, Al, where are you going? And I said, well, I'm going out there. And he goes, well, what, do you want to flip him off? And I went, well, yeah, you know. And he stepped aside and he said, go right ahead. He was just checking to see if I was coherent and all that, you know, and knew what I was doing. And so I got out there and quite honestly, because it was under yellow, it was taking Emerson a while to come back around, and he was coming around to get the checkered flag. And it was a moment of clarity, is the only thing I can say about it today. Is you know, I saw the grandstands, you know, it was like standing in the middle of the Super Bowl, because there was just people everywhere, to the left, to the right, in front of me, just, you know, people everywhere, and it hit me that, you know, they're all expecting me to do one thing. And so I had a moment of clarity, of just reflecting on the race.
Little Al would finish fourth in 1990 and 91, but he was beginning to wonder whether he'd ever win the 500. Big Al's career was also winding down. He wasn't even in the 1991 race, but both would put on a show the next year in cars not expected to be at the front. Al Jr. qualified 12th. Al Sr. rolled off 22nd on the unusually cold day. While the accidents whittled down the rest of the field, both Unsers moved up steadily, but neither seemed to be a threat to Michael Andretti's super-fast machine. By the second half of the race, as much of the field was sidelined, the two Unsers found themselves in the top five, and Big Al looked to pull a rabbit out of his hat surprising everyone by blowing past the day's dominant car.
Here's Larry Henry in three.
Al Unser! Al Unser has passed Michael Andretti! Al Unser now has passed Michael Andretti, the Buick powered. Is something going wrong with Michael's car? He is a lot slower than Al Unser now.
Al Sr. led for only four laps, but was primed to grab another win, just in case another dominant Andretti drive ended in disappointment.
And the pace is about 221 miles an hour, and Larry, is he slowing down?
Michael Andretti, the leader, is slowing down, coming down the back straightaway. Oh, my goodness! Michael Andretti going slowly, heading down to the inside! Unbelievable!
With 11 laps to go, the Andretti luck bit Michael on the day he led 160 laps. Once again, Unsers were in the right position to grab the prize, with Al Jr. inheriting the lead and Sr. moving up to third. But little Al would have all he could handle after that final restart from the man who started last that day, Scott Goodyear.
Two more laps to go. Will it be Al Unser Jr. or Scott Goodyear in the 500?
Al Unser Jr.'s won almost $1.5 million here, but he's never won the race, and he's got a lot of work to do. Already in a short shoot, that gap gets closer, Gary.
Keep those cameras ready. We could have a photo finish once again, about three or four car lengths as they work down the backstretch. Who's it going to be in turn three, Larry?
Seven Indianapolis 500 victories already in the Unser family. Al Jr. trying to add one more. It's about a two-car length advantage on Goodyear this time through three.
They head into turn four. Little Al holding him off. Scott Goodyear right behind him. Just over a lap to go. They head to the main straightaway. The start-finish line. Who's going to get it?
Dwayne Sweeney waves the white flag. One to go. A three-car length separation between Unser and Goodyear.
And that's how they come through number one. The gap gets closer and closer and closer in front of Gary Lee.
Indeed, about three or four car lengths as they work off the second corner for the last time. Headed down the backstretch. Headed right at you, Larry Henry.
Scott Goodyear, Chuck right in behind Al Unser Jr. He's waiting. He's waiting about a car length and a half behind Al Jr. Al Jr. now lengthens it out. He's trying to hold him off. Goodyear low. Jr. high. They go to four, Bob Levy.
Al Unser Jr. has the lead. One more turn to go. Here they come. Coming to the finish line. Bob Jenkins, who's going to win it?
The checkered flag is out. Goodyear makes a move. Little Al wins by just a few tenths of a second. Perhaps the closest finish in the history of the Indianapolis 500. Al Unser Jr. has become the first second-generation driver to win an Indianapolis 500. Al Unser Jr. has done it.
Al Unser Jr. was finally a champion at the Brickyard and in Victory Lane. He summed up what many fans and drivers have always felt about the tract of land at the corner of 16th and Georgetown.
There sounds like there's some tears in your voice right now.
Well, you just don't know what Indy means.
All of these emotions came rushing at me at once, you know, pulling out there in 1983 at rookie orientation, running interference for my dad that first year in 1983 and wanting my dad to win so bad, and his tires were off or something at the end of the race, and there I am trying to keep Tom Sneva behind so that my dad could win the race, just all these emotions, you know, just came rushing at me all at once, you know, coming so close in 89 and not doing it.
The next year, both father and son led again. Al Jr. for 17 laps on his way to eighth place, and Sr. adding to his all-time laps led total with 15 in his final 500. For the 1994 Indy 500, Little Al was on his own, but he had joined his father's old team, the powerful Penske organization. And the team had a dominant Mercedes-Benz engine that made them even more the odds-on favorite than usual. Little Al started on the pole for his only time in his 500 career and appeared the only other car capable of keeping him out of victory lane was his old rival and now teammate, Emerson Fittipaldi. Emo dominated, leading 145 laps, and was about to lap second place Al Jr. when it all went south for the Brazilian.
And four, crash.
Got Emerson Fittipaldi has hit the wall on the inside coming through four. That means Al Unser pulling away, but Emo, his teammate, hit the wall coming through four just down below us. He kept it going. It should be in the main straightaway.
Unbelievable. The car comes to a stop just a few feet short of the start-finish line. Emo raises his hands as if to say, I can't believe what has happened.
Al Jr. went on to grab his second 500 win in 3 years and the ninth in the family's amazing Indianapolis history. But big changes were coming. The next year, the Penske team didn't even make the race. And due to the open wheel war, Al Jr. wouldn't race again in the 500 until 2000. He only led one race for one lap in his last seven attempts at the greatest spectacle in racing, managing just one top 10 finish before finally retiring after the 2007 500. While Al Jr. was away, two more Unsers carried on the family tradition. Johnny Unser, son of the late Jerry, made an emotional debut at the Brickyard in 1996. But like his father, he didn't complete a lap in his rookie race. Johnny would make five starts at IMS with a top finish of 18th. Bobby's son Robbie arrived on the scene in 1998 and made an immediate impact. The last Unser to compete in the 500 finished fifth as a rookie, and backed that up with an eighth-place finish, his only other start. Coming up next, we'll look at some of the other sons of former winners, and Donald has a trivia question for you. This is Heroes of the 500. This is the Heroes of the 500, the Family Ties edition. I'm Steve Simpson. In the previous segments, we've discussed several sons of Indianapolis 500 winners who had considerable success at the Brickyard. But several sons of former winners, for a variety of reasons, never had the same success as their famous fathers. Parnelli Jones' son, PJ, is a talented off-road racer and road racer who also raced in NASCAR. But PJ Jones' best finish in his two starts was 19th. Ari Leyendyke won the 500 in 1990 and 1997. Son Ari Jr. made one start, finishing 28th in 2006. A.J. Foyt has had a son and a grandson follow him into the greatest spectacle in racing. Son Larry's best finish in three starts was 30th in 2006. He now is the team manager for the Foyt Racing Team. A.J. Foyt IV competed in the 500 six times with the best finish of 14th in 2007.
Just because your father has been successful at something doesn't mean to say that you're going to be as good as he is, because there may be something in the genes, but also you are an individual. He went out and did it. Now you've got to go out and do it. And I think that it opens doors. I mean, if you've got a name, people will at least be interested in you. But then once you get in there, then I think there's a lot of expectancy, so it probably puts a lot of pressure on it.
Driver Graham Rahal knows what it's like following in the footsteps of a legend, such as his father, the 1986 Indy 500 winner Bobby. And that family legacy leads to rivalries against other famous families, like the Andretti's.
If there's one person I'd hate to see win the Indy 500, it's Marco Andretti. If there's one person he'd probably hate to see win it, it's probably me. You know, I mean, that's just the way that it is. And, you know, he's a nice guy, but certainly doesn't mean that we don't want to beat him.
The younger Rahal now drives full-time for his famous father, and Marco Andretti also drives for his dad. It's just an extension of the battles that Michael Andretti and Bobby Rahal had on the tracks all over the country.
I think it comes from, there's a lot of things, but certainly our fathers is probably the biggest part of it. It's stirred by quite a few things in life, and that's just the way that it is. But, you know, the Rahals, the Andretti's, that rivalry that's gone back so many years is definitely the biggest part of it. You know, Marco and I have raced each other for many, many, many years now, but he's one guy that we love to beat.
But having a famous family member in racing can also be a double-edged sword at times. Some outstanding drivers toiled in the shadows of more famous brothers. Jerry Sneva was Rookie of the Year in 1977, but was overshadowed by older brother Tom, the 1983 winner. Roger Mears was an outstanding off-road racer, but many fans only know him as the brother of four-time winner Rick Mears and the father of NASCAR's Casey. Speedway historian Donald Davidson says the lack of recognition for some of the members of racing families could occasionally sting.
I can think of three where the other brother had not nearly the accomplishments, if any, and they never complain, but you can tell there's hurt. And Jerry Sneva is a perfect example where you would have, I mean, I think he had the goods, and just not, but he just drove cars that were, we know what we're thinking about in racing vernacular, not the best of equipment. And it would have been interesting to see if he could have been Tom's teammate on Penske. And the same with Roger. Now, Roger was extremely pleasant, older than Rick. And I think that Rick came to fall in love with the Speedway. I don't think there was love there at the first. It seemed like he just sort of pretty much took it for granted. Roger, the older brother, cherished the Speedway and had great regard and knowledge of it, and was almost pinching himself that he was here. Then the other one, of course, is Aldo Andretti, who never even got to the point of, just barely getting on the track. He did test one during tire tests, but, he couldn't get a USAC championship license, and that was very sad. He never complained, but you thought there's got to be some pain there.
There's actually one notable case of a son exceeding his father's accomplishments at the Brickyard. Donald promised you a trivia question in this segment, so here it is.
There's been several 500 winners that had a son drive in the race, sometimes victorious and sometimes not, who was the only person to win the Indianapolis 500 as a driver and be able to say, my father drove in the 500 and didn't win. And there's only one. The answer is Buddy Lazier. His father, Bob, drove in the race, and I think a lot of people probably may not have known that. He drove in 1981 and dropped out, finished 19th. And then 8 years later, then Buddy came along and then took the test in 1989. It was 91 before he made it. But I think that's kind of interesting that of all the family relationships and fathers and son, he is the only, once again, the only driver to win the Indianapolis 500 and have a father who drove in the 500 before him but didn't win.
When we come back, we continue our look at famous families of the 500 with two star-crossed clans that remain among the most popular in the history of the event. This is Heroes of the 500. This is Heroes of the 500, the Family Ties Edition. I'm Steve Simpson. Welcome to Hour 2 of our special tribute to the famous families that have become legendary at the world's most famous race course. We pick up the story with two star-crossed clans who each were touched by tragedy at the Brickyard. Vukovic and Bettenhausen may not be common surnames, but they became household names in the early 50s. Bill Vukovic first came to IMS in 1950, took his rookie test in the same car that Wilbur Shaw drove to victory in 1939 and 40. But 10 years later, the ride was too long in the tooth to make the show. The next year, Vuki made the 500 field but dropped out early, finishing 29th. But his reputation as a charger earned him a ride with reclusive businessman Howard Keck's team. Paired with the Whiz Kids, mechanics Jim Travers and Frank Kuhn, the team dominated the 1952 500, leading 150 laps. Vukovic seemed on his way to a sure victory when a pin in the steering column failed.
So Vukovic, who was within 8 laps of possibly winning this year's 500, is out of the race. And Troy Ruttman, in car number 98, a seemingly dark horse before this race today, is now leading. He's in first place, 3 laps ahead of Jim Ruttman in car number 59. All Ruttman has to do is keep a speed of about 118 or 20 miles an hour and coast on in.
Vukovic finished 8th up against the wall instead of kissing actress Arlene Dahl in victory lane. The next year, Vukovic showed he was no flash in the pan. He qualified on the pole, actually finishing the run in the rain. On race day, the man known as the Mad Russian, even though he was neither, beat the rest of the field into submission on a blistering hot day. Vukovic led 195 of the 200 laps to grab his first Indianapolis 500 win.
He's been gone about a minute. He should be coming down the straightaway. Here he comes, getting the check. Gets a tremendous cheer from the crowd. He waves the crowd as he goes by. Car number 14, Bill Vukovic, has won the 1953 500 mile race.
Think you want relief anytime in the race?
No.
Never wanted relief. There's an Ironman, folks, and he's really tired and he can't hear a single thing.
Many fans forget that the following year was just as hot, and in 1954, Vukovic wasn't happy with the dominant fuel injection special. The Mad Russian didn't even qualify on opening weekend and had to settle for 19th on the grid. But author Bob Gates says one of the Whiz Kids figured out what was wrong with the previously dominant roadster.
If there was a race he should not have won, it was 1954, and the problem was they had engine issues all month long. They had done a lot of trick stuff prior to Indianapolis with ram tuning, for instance, on the off engine, the first time that ever been done. Jim Travers told me they saw 50 horsepower right away over what they'd ever seen. But when they got to the track and started running, in Vookie's terminology, it was like he was dragging a ton of bricks. that was the type of terminology Vookie used to describe it. He said once he was practicing, and he said, Troy Ruttman came by me so fast that I was so embarrassed, I put my hand up and pulled in like I intended to. He said that's how bad they were running. They didn't get qualified on the first weekend. And when they did get qualified, it was in 19th place, back in the middle of the pack. And they did not find out what the problem was until actually the day after carb day. And what they determined was that the pistons, which were of a new design that year, had not been grooved properly. And Frank Kuhn, who was an excellent engine man, re-grooved the pistons by hand. They put the engine back together. And he said he gave it a couple of womp, womp, womps, you know, to warm it up and let it go. And they ran all day. After the race, Frank Kuhn said the engine oil was black. It looked like coal oil, where it scraped so much metal off the cylinder walls.
When the green flag dropped, Vukovic and the fuel injection special came to life, leading 90 laps on the way to back-to-back checkered flags.
We're watching for him, Outer Easy. The checkered flag is out. Bill Vandewater is watching very carefully. Would want to give the wrong man the checkered flag. The white flag goes out for Jimmy Bryan. The other boys are getting it too. There's Bill Vukovic going by, getting the checkered flag as the winner of the 1954 500-mile race.
For 1955, Vukovic had a new team. Howard Keck had closed shop unexpectedly, so Vookie and the Whiz Kids moved on to Lindsey Hopkins' organization. Vukovic looked well on his way to an unprecedented third straight 500 win when disaster struck.
Bill Vukovic evidently going to the outside to miss the trouble, went over the wall, and that car is still burning over there. Now, the drivers, car number 27, Roger Ward, got out and is over on the grass. He looks to be all right. Ed Elysian didn't hit anybody, and he was all right. Car number 42 with Al Keller driving, he looks to be all right. Johnny Boyd was still sitting in the car when it came to a rest. On its back, it was turned over, and they helped Johnny out of the car. He's sitting on the grass and looks to be all right. Now, what happened to Bill Vukovic? We have no information.
A few moments later, the voice of the 500, Sid Collins, made a tragic and shocking announcement.
Bill Vukovic, three-time winner of the 500-mile race, almost trying for his third consecutive today, trapped in his car in the backstretch, was injured fatally. Bill Vukovic has died as a result of injuries suffered on the backstretch in the accident reported to you earlier on this broadcast.
There was perhaps no more dominant driver in 500 history than Bill Vukovic. Of the 676 laps he ran at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, he led 485 of them. Bill Vukovic II was home in California playing in the yard when the somber news broke. Originally, the younger Vukovic wanted to pursue a baseball career. But when he finally made his way into the family business, he made an immediate impact, winning Rookie of the Year in 1968. Bill Vukovic II started 12 Indianapolis 500s, finishing second in 1973 and third the next year.
Bill, the middle one, is a very interesting person. He gets needled a lot by his friends, but that's because they love him. And he's a very intelligent guy with a lot of interests beyond racing. He's interested in a lot of stuff that people don't realize. I mean, he's interested in science. So, I mean, he'll be talking about, planets and then the stock market. And he jumps around all over the place. And he is very proud of his dad. And you think, well, there's got to be some hurt there. And yes, there was. But he is very, very proud to this day. And we'll ask about his dad and the people that he ran against. There's another thing also about Vuk II, to identify him, is that has never changed. He was always very self-effacing about his career. Even when he had a second and a third, and he was always sort of downplaying the career. And I don't know whether that was because he wanted people to say, no, you're really good, for some kind of validation, or whether he just, but that is something that's never changed. He just downplays the career and just basically says, well, you know, I, I wasn't that great or something. I think, have you ever looked at the record books? Have you looked at the stats?
Author Bob Gates.
Bill Vukovich Jr. was really a very talented race car driver. The year before he went to Indianapolis, he was the hottest driver in America. With the number of feature wins that he had in super modifieds and midget sprint cars. It was just incredible. He didn't quite have the success that his father had, but who could have?
In 1988, Bill Vukovich III would make his Speedway debut, matching his father by grabbing Rookie of the Year honors. Speedway historian Donald Davidson says the second and third generation of the famous family were exceptionally close.
Billy III was so close with both of them. Bill and Joyce were so well matched for each other, it seemed, and they had the boy, and I think he stayed with them. I don't know that he ever had his own place. He stayed with them, and they were all very, very close, and it was almost, they were a trio, and it was almost like Billy III was their kid brother, is the way that it seemed to me.
Billy III qualified for three 500s with the best finish of 12th. But tragedy struck the family again when the young driver was killed in a sprint car race in November of 1990.
I know that when he was back here and qualifying in 88, Bill was just a basket case, you know, but he extremely proud of his son and loved his son, and but also was proud of him for what he was accomplishing. And so when Billy III lost his life in late 1990, it was just right before New Year's, as I recall, that weighed heavily. I mean, I don't know that he's ever recovered, really, but for the longest time, he became very reclusive and all perfectly understandable.
Like their contemporaries from California, the Bettenhausen clan of Tinley Park, Illinois, was also touched by tragedy at the Brickyard. Tony Bettenhausen was a two-time national driving champion who won 22 races on the IndyCar trail. He shared a second-place finish with his buddy Paul Russo at the 1955 500. But he was also known as Cementhead for his hard-headed ways and tendency to choose the wrong car to drive at the wrong time. Author Bob Gates.
For instance, it's 1951. He did not drive the Bellinger Special at Indianapolis, and it won the Indianapolis 500. He made a decision not to drive that car at Indianapolis. But he did drive it on the rest of the championship trail, won a half a dozen races, and the national championship. And I believe that year he actually chose to drive one of the Blue Crown Specials, a front-wheel drive car whose technology, you know, by that point was gone.
Bettenhausen was the favorite in 1961 when he chose to jump into Russo's car to help his buddy find some speed the day before qualifying. While practicing in Russo's car, the popular Bettenhausen crashed on the front stretch and was fatally injured. 7 years later, another Bettenhausen picked up the torch. Son Gary, who made a name running USAC stock cars, sprints, and midgets, made his debut in 1968, the same year as Bill Vukovich II. But it wouldn't be until he linked up with car owner Roger Penske that Bettenhausen would have a chance to grab the trophy his father so desperately wanted. Bettenhausen started fourth in 1972 and led 138 of the first 182 laps before fate would intervene, denying the crowd what would have been a popular win.
The last two laps that Gary Bettenhausen has gone by, his engine is extremely sour. We took our headset off to get a closer listen, as we're only about 50 feet away from him, and his engine is sour, and he's up the backstretch now, but he is not at racing speed.
Bettenhausen was sidelined with ignition failure, while teammate Mark Donahue went on to give Penske his first 500 win. Bettenhausen would finish fifth the next year, but didn't want to give up racing sprint cars. Penske made it clear to his driver that his focus needed to be Indy cars. When Bettenhausen was badly injured in a sprint car accident, Penske fired him. Bob Gates says Bettenhausen came by the nickname Son of Cementhead, honestly.
We look at Gary and the decision he made to go ahead and drive dirt cars, dirt championship cars, when Roger Penske asked him not to. And, of course, it's very well known, you know, if Gary hadn't got hurt in the dirt championship car, we maybe never would have heard of Rick Mears because Gary Bettenhausen would have been in that spot winning all those Indianapolis 500. So I think some of it is maybe the decisions they made for whatever reason. Tony Sr. was known as old seaman head, and Gary was just as stubborn.
Bettenhausen's best finish would come in 1980 in a car that even the driver didn't think had a chance. Speedway historian Donald Davidson.
The 1980 race where he got third is a great story because Sherman Armstrong was trying to run five cars, and basically he and Paul Efter, the chief mechanic, said, look, you know, we don't have enough people to go around, but if you can get a crew together, the car is yours. So it was a four-year-old Wildcat, and so he gets Willie Davis and everything and qualified in the back row. And it's funny how this works out because there's other drivers that thought, I can win. And then there's other years where they thought, you know, this is not going to be the year. And then it works out well. So he actually came to the track that morning and he told his wife and the twin boys, all right, now just pay attention all day and listen to the PA. And be ready to go to the parking lot, because as soon as this blankety blank blows up, we're going home and we'll beat the traffic home. And he stays in there and finishes third.
Gary's younger brother, Tony, would make his 500 debut the next year with an impressive seventh place finish. Over 11 starts, the younger Tony Bettenhausen had three top 10 finishes and started his own race team before losing his life in a plane crash on Valentine's Day 2000.
Gary was in the modern era, but still trying to do it the old way. And Tony was very much, in fact, Merle said, Tony is a now driver, and he put his own deal together. And he had three top 10, so he was a very consistent finisher and was able to do an amazing amount without a great, you know, without a lot of resources. And he had a lot of people supporting him because they liked him, and he went about it in a very businesslike just a very gentlemanly manner.
A third brother, Merle, practiced at the Speedway but never made the 500. He was seriously injured in an IndyCar race at Michigan International Speedway in 1972. Next, we'll fire up the Wayback Machine for some early 500 family connections, including one of the most famous names in the auto industry, Chevrolet. This is Heroes of the 500. This is Heroes of the 500, the Family Ties Edition. I'm Steve Simpson. We continue our look back at the history of family ties at the Indianapolis 500, the greatest spectacle in racing, has seen plenty of brothers battling each other over the 103-year history of the event. In fact, in 1982, three Whittington brothers, Bill, Don, and Dale, all qualified for the race. But the Whittingtons were certainly not the first brother combo in the great event's history. For that, you need to go all the way back to the race's debut year of 1911, for the little-known combination of Bill and Harry Endicott. Speedway historian Donald Davidson with their story.
They both ran 1911, 12, and 13. And Harry did not start in the 1913 race, but he was a relief driver for the brothers. So they actually shared a car. Harry lost his life in an accident. I think it was a dirt track at Jackson, Michigan, I believe, in 1913. But he lived in Indianapolis. I'm not sure. I think they were from the Crawfordsville area, but they both did live in Indianapolis. Bill Endicott, I think, had a farm in Crawfordsville. And then after the brother was fatally injured, he didn't drive at the Speedway anymore. He did run IMCA for a while, and then he ended up working at the track, doing odd jobs. I mean, I think he was sort of like on the maintenance crew into, golly, like 1940. He worked for Marmon Harrington, which is they took over the Duesenberg property at Washington and Harding. So he was all sort of kind of in the area.
The same year that the Endicotts and the Indianapolis 500 made their debut on the scene, so did another rookie, whose last name would become famous worldwide. Arthur Chevrolet finished 36th in 1911 and came back one more time for an 18th place in 1916. That same year, he drove against his older brother, Louis, who was making his second of four starts in the 500 with the best finish of 9th in 1919. By that time, the brothers had started the Chevrolet Motor Car Company with General Motors founder William Durant and other investors.
So Louis and Arthur were the two that gave their name to the Chevrolet Motor Company, but I mean, they weren't wealthy people at all. Billy Durant had General Motors and was starting up all these companies, and Louis and Arthur were race drivers and engineers. And so the name Chevrolet Motor Company was given, but I mean, they weren't millionaires by any sense, and in fact, they had a disagreement with Billy Durant and left the company very quickly. I think no sooner had Chevrolet's begun to hit the ground, and at the time it was just one of dozens and dozens and dozens of companies. I mean, it wasn't a giant by any means, but no sooner had they started production than they left.
After the brothers sold their interest in the Chevrolet company in what now would seem like a massive conflict of interest, the Chevrolet brothers spent their time making racing parts for Ford Model Ts. In 1919, their youngest brother, Gaston, made his 500 debut, finishing 10th. But the next year, driving a Monroe Fronti, Chevrolet broke through, winning the greatest spectacle in racing after leading just 14 laps. But the joy was short-lived as Chevrolet was killed just 6 months later on the board track at Beverly Hills. Gaston Chevrolet became the first 500 winner to lose his life.
Louis gets a lot of credit, and deservedly so. And Arthur does not get the credit that he should. So Louis in the Hall of Fame, or at least the Auto Racing Hall of Fame, and Arthur never got enough votes. And that's kind of sad, because his contributions, I would say, were probably, this is just me, but my personal opinion, I think his contributions were more significant than Gaston. But Gaston made it, and I think it's because of the Indianapolis win, plus the name, the assumption that he was part of it.
Another early brother combination was Andre and George Bolo. Donald Davidson says the elder Bolo carries an unusual distinction, despite his one 500 start.
George Bolo drove only in 1914, and then Andre was the younger brother, and he drove 19 through 21. Anyway, George Bolo was a very flamboyant and a very proud man, and in fact, he didn't even come to Indianapolis in 1913. I mean, he and Gou were teammates on the Peugeot team, and Boileau won the French Grand Prix in 1912, and in fact would win it in 1913. But when the team came in 13, you know, obviously that hadn't happened yet. But the thinking would be, well, Boileau and Gou will come together. Anyway, so Boileau comes in 1914, and almost did a 100-mile-an-hour lap. They were qualifying by single laps in those days, and he did, I think it was 99.48 miles an hour, and then he doesn't return in 1915, as do none of the other the leading Europeans that had come in 13 and 14, because they became involved in World War I. And so Boileau was a pilot, and got shot down over Verdun, or however that's pronounced, V-E-R-D-U-N, which is very close to the German border. And he was shot down, I think, on May 21st, 1916. So within 2 years of having set the track record at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, you know, that's one of the more unusual demises of all time.
Another early family combination included one of the most dominant drivers the Brickyard has ever known. Ralph DePalma made his debut in the first year of the 500 in 1911, finishing sixth. The next year, he dominated, leading 196 of the first 198 laps before a cracked piston sidelined the car on the way to victory, leaving him in 11th place. 3 years later, DePalma finally grabbed his long-awaited win, leading 132 of the 200 laps, part of a stretch where the Italian led at least 75 laps in four straight races.
Number one, I would say that Ralph DePalma was probably the outstanding driver of the early years. I think it's difficult to make statements like that, but I think that if you had to take one driver from the beginning of the 500 and go up through until Wilbur Shaw came along, I think DePalma would be the man, probably, for several reasons. But He did have a brother. When he won in 1915, it's a neat trivia question, you know, to name the people who won the Indianapolis 500 and had a brother in the field. That actually happened several times. And he would be the first because Johnny DePalma, the brother, only had one start, but it happened to be the year that Ralph won.
DePalma was so dominant that he led 612 laps in his career, still good for second all time, nearly 90 years after he stopped driving. DePalma always felt that he was more well known for the one he lost on lap 198 than the one he won.
Hard to forget the one I did not finish in 1912 because everyone liked to talk about it.
That's right.
Everyone reads about it. There have been more lines written about the race that I did not win than there did on the one that I did win in 1915. Of course, they call it hard luck. Well, I often say that I don't think it was hard luck. It's just breaks of the game.
At one point, DePalma's riding mechanic was his nephew, Pete DiPaolo, who went on to his own stellar career.
And he was a great character. I mean, he was an excellent representative for the sport because he was well-spoken. He was a tiny little guy and had this real basso voice, but he had a presence. I mean, he would walk into a room and you know, singing an aria, and he had a lot of class about him. But he came into the sport as the riding mechanic for Uncle Ralph. And in 20 and 21, you know, DePalma led the greater number of laps for both of those years. And Peter's riding with him. And then they went to the 1921 French Grand Prix, where DePalma got second with Peter as the riding mechanic. And then by 22, he's driving. And I think there was maybe a little bit of a rift between the two at some point. Peter writes about that, and I don't quite, you know, understand all of that. But anyway, then Peter comes along, and I don't know if Uncle Ralph felt that Peter shouldn't be doing it because it was dangerous or whatever, even although he was okay to do it himself. And then Peter wins the race in 1925. And Uncle Ralph finished seventh. But Peter was one of, I think there's 24 people who were in the race both as a driver and a riding mechanic.
DePalma became the first Indianapolis 500 winner to win with an average speed of over 100 miles an hour. And he loved recounting the tale for fans.
All through the race, I had the confidence that I was going to win. Matter of fact, I'd sing. I'd go down the backstretch singing, oh, boy, I'm lucky. I'll say I'm lucky. Get over, buddy, let me by. I didn't say nice words all the time, but it was very, very interesting. And they all thought I was going too fast. And the weather was terribly hot. It was 96 temperature. So you can imagine what the track temperature must have been. They said he'll never make it, he'll never hold it. But as a matter of fact, after the first 25 laps, I could look back the entire length of the home stretch, nobody in sight. And that's why I tell them I enjoy my most pleasant thrill. Every time I cross a line, all alone, $100, $100, $100, it was a marvelous feeling.
We've profiled several father and son combinations that have made the Indianapolis 500 great. But the first time a son followed in his father's footsteps came very early in the history of the event.
Well, yeah, how long was it before a son of a former 500 driver drove in the race? Not very long, 1937. And it was Billy DeVore, who had been a riding mechanic. He rode in 31, 32, 33, and 34. And then, in fact, all the way up through 35, I think. But anyway, he was a riding mechanic. He rode with Wilbur Short a second in 1933. And it was not unusual then for a riding mechanic then to become a driver. It was a way to get into it. So anyway, so 37 was the first start that he had. And he ran actually all the way up through 1954. He didn't make it every year. But he was a steady Eddie. He would normally qualify near the back and then run all day and bring them home. So he had top 10 finishes.
DeVore's father, Earl, lost his life in unusual circumstances at the height of his driving career.
The father was actually more accomplished in that he would run up front. And in 1920, but he actually drove before World War I, and then disappears for a while, and then he was one of the outstanding drivers on the board tracks. And then 1927, he was second in the 500, took a relief driver, Zeke Meyer, who was not related to Louis Meyer, but people did used to get them mixed up. And then in 1928, he and another driver named Norman Batten, who relieved Peter DiPaolo when he won in 1935. But anyway, the two of them had made an arrangement to take their cars down to South America. I mean, I don't know how these contacts were ever made, but other people would do that. And so they went down to run in, you know, Argentina and Brazil, I guess. I don't know how all of that came about, but they actually left on a ship called the SS Vestris, and this is late November of 1928, with their wives, and it got caught in a storm, and it took water, and apparently it took a while for this thing to sink. So I was when you first read about it or just see a line or two, it ends up being something other than what, I mean, I would just assume that they got in a storm at night. I just always had in mind with, you know, lashing rain and everything. Well, apparently the thing took water off the coast of Virginia, heading for points down in South America, and it took water, and then the thing was slow to sink. I mean, it took like a number of hours. And then when they started to get the women and children first off, and then both the wives both escaped and made it back to the United States, but DeVore and Batten both met their demise. And I wasn't sure how. I know that I've heard about, you know, sharks being involved, but I don't. You know, I can't be very specific on that. And I think just say both of them went down on the SS Vestris. So there's just been, with now 749 drivers driving the 500, but the way that some of them met their end is interesting. I mean, with private plane crashes and aerial combat and, you know, going down on a ship, and there's been some other odd ones as well.
Coming up next, we'll look at some family connections who play the name game. This is Heroes of the 500. This is Heroes of the 500, the Family Ties Edition. I'm Steve Simpson. What's in a name? Well, when you're talking about our next two famous families of the 500, plenty. Over the years, Speedway historian Donald Davidson has taken thousands of calls in his program, The Talk of Gasoline Alley. One question seems to come up each year. Did 1960 Indianapolis 500 winner Jim Rathman actually switch names with his brother Dick? Donald says in this case, you can't tell the players without a scorecard.
What happened was Jim, as we know him, is 2.5 years younger than Dick, as we know him. And Dick was James, and Jim was Richard. And Richard, Jim, wanted to drive track roadsters when he was 16, I think. And so basically there was this wonderful, really exciting group of people that all came up together. You know, Jack McGrath and Manny Aiello and Pat Flaherty and A.J. Watson and Jim Rathman and Troy Ruttman. They knew each other as teenagers. So anyway, in order for Jim to start racing, he was, I think, 16. And so what he did was to borrow his brother's identity and race with that for a few months before the older brother, who I don't think had given a lot of attention to it, thought, hey, that looks like a pretty good gig. Let me try that. So then he came in, and by which time the younger brother's age had increased another year or two to where it would be more appropriate for him to be driving a race car. And so fortunately, they never changed the identities back. But, to this day, well, they're both deceased now, but Dick is really Jim, and Jim is really Dick. And fortunately, you know, as I say, that they didn't try to correct that.
To confuse the story even further, the driver who won the 1960 Indianapolis 500 actually had a completely different first name, which didn't come to light until years later.
Jim, as we know him, went by Richard, but that actually was his middle name. And because he had appeared in a couple of times. He would appear as Richard R. Rathman. And so I asked him in later years, may I ask what the R stood for? I said, were you Richard R. Rathman? And he said, well, actually, Richard is my middle name. And he said, my first name was Royal, R-O-Y-A-L. And he said, it's a nice name, but I never used it. He was very proud of it. And I thought, God, I would love to be, because people have been asking for years, you know, because there's been other drivers that they did not either use, they either had a completely different name or they would modify it slightly for some reason. And some didn't mind that being known, and others that you knew, like some didn't like their name. So I respect that. But he never used it, but there was a twinkle in his eye. And I thought, well, out of respect for him, I'll sit on it. But then when he passed away, and I talked to the widow and the son about it, Jimmy, and I said, look, I've got to write in a bit here, and I'm really motivated. I really want to give out what his name was, but I didn't want to do that while he was living. And what do you think? And they said, go for it. That's what his name was. And I said, nobody knows that. And so his name was actually Royal Richard Rathman.
The name swap aside, both drivers were outstanding talents. In addition to his 1960 win, Jim Rathman also had 3 second place finishes among his 5 top 5 finishes in the 500. Brother Dick started on the pole once in 1958 and rolled off from the first 2 rows 6 times in his 9 race career in the 500. Best finish of 5th in 1956. In addition, Dick Rathman won 13 NASCAR races.
I don't know that they were particularly close. And unlike some other brothers, they did look alike. I mean, there's definitely features that you can just tell that they're brothers. But their personalities were very different, and I don't know that they were that close. I would say that Jim, as we know him, was a lot more polished and a businessman. I think Dick was a little more, you know, a little rougher around the edges. But he had success that you really don't think about. I mean, he had success in NASCAR. He was in the top 3 in points, or the top 4 or 5 in points, like 3 years in a row.
Another family combination has the unusual distinction of participating in the greatest spectacle in racing with the exact same first and last name, but a different pronunciation. After a couple of crashes the 2 previous years, in 1986, Jacques Villeneuve finally qualified for what would be his only Indianapolis 500 start. He finished 20th. The previous year, Villeneuve had become the first Canadian to win an IndyCar race when the brother of Formula One star Gilles took the checkered flag at Road America in Wisconsin. 8 years later, Gilles' son would arrive on the scene and finish 2nd in the 500, grabbing Rookie of the Year honors. Coincidentally, just like his uncle, he would also snag his first career win at Road America that same year. But this driver, despite having the exact same first and last name, chooses to pronounce it Jack Villeneuve. No matter how it's said, it's synonymous with winner, as the next year Villeneuve won racing's biggest prize, the Indianapolis 500, and the IndyCar Championship. 2 years later, he bagged Formula One's world title. 3 additional Formula One world champions have raced in the 500 and then went on to see family members also compete in the greatest spectacle in racing. In 1961, world champion Jack Brabham ushered in the rear engine revolution when he qualified his Cooper Climax 13th on the way to a 9th place finish. Brabham would make 3 more starts with his rookie race, ending up being his best finish. His son Jeff would never win the world title, but he fared better at the Brickyard, bagging a 4th in 1983 and 5th as a rookie in 1981. Jeff Brabham made 10 Indy 500 starts, and there could soon be a 3rd generation of the family tree in the 500, as Jeff's son Matthew currently drives in Indy Lights. You'll hear from him in our next segment. In 1984, the IndyCar world was shocked when 2-time world champion Emerson Fittipaldi showed up at the Brickyard with a pink car. But just 4 years later, the Brazilian finished 2nd to Rick Mears, and the next year, he grabbed the big prize.
The checkered flag and the yellow being waved, Emerson Fittipaldi waving back, he's your winner.
Emo led the most laps the next year, but finished 3rd to Ari Leyendijk. 3 years later, he was in position to steal another BorgWarner trophy from another former world champion.
And the green flag is out. We are back to racing, and Emerson Fittipaldi makes a move on Nigel Mansell. He's got him going into one, but Lion Dyke is also right there.
Oh, they went side by side, and Mansell fell all the way back to third place. Gary, we got him coming right at you.
As they work through turn two, that may be the inexperience on restarts on the oval for Nigel Mansell. Right now, he is falling to third place as they work up the backstretch.
Fittipaldi went on to win the 1993 500 and dominated the next year, crashing with nearly a lap lead less than 20 laps from the finish. It turned out to be Emo's final 500, but his dominance was established. He finished his career as one of just six drivers to lead over 500 laps in his Indy 500 career. The next year, Fittipaldi's nephew nearly grabbed the trophy in his one and only start in the 500. Christian Fittipaldi has a unique box score in that he started 27th and never led a lap in his only 500, but still finished second. Emerson Fittipaldi has one more family to the connection to the 500. His daughter is married to Max Pappas, who drove in the race in 2002 and 2006. Coming up next, we'll wrap up our look at the famous families of the Brickyard. This is Heroes of the 500. This is Heroes of the 500, the Family Ties Edition. I'm Steve Simpson. Over its 103-year history, the Indianapolis 500 has seen dozens of drivers with family ties compete in the greatest spectacle in racing. As of May 1st, 2014, 749 drivers have started the 500, 77 of them have had at least one blood relative who also can be found on the starting driver list. And as you've heard, they come from a wide variety of racing backgrounds. The Allison brothers made their name in NASCAR, but both Bobby and Donnie competed in the 500, with Donnie winning Rookie of the Year honors in 1970 after a fourth-place finish. In his only other start, the younger Allison grabbed sixth place in 1971.
Donnie had by far the best results, and he drove for Foyt, and I think that was kind of a mutual thing. I mean, I've talked to both of them about it, and you know, rather than they were good friends because Foyt would run NASCAR, so he had great respect for, you know, for the leading guys, and so Donnie, I think, always had Indianapolis at the back of his mind, even from when he was young, I think. So, he did drive modified, so he had driven some open wheel, although virtually the entire career was stock car. So he comes here, and in a nutshell, he's fourth the first year. Fourth, you know? And then sixth the next year. And those are the only 2 years that he ran.
Dwayne Carter was a highly respected sprint car driver who took part in 11 Indianapolis 500s with a best finish of fourth. He's the father of 1985 Indy 500 pole winner Dwayne Carter Jr., better known as Poncho. But what many may not remember is that he had a stepson from a famous racing family as well. Speedway historian Donald Davidson with that story.
The belief is that Dwayne Carter and Johnny Parsons traded wives and married each other's wives. Well, not exactly. What happened was Johnny Parsons and his wife was Arzer, and they divorced, and she married Dwayne Carter. But then Johnny Parsons Sr. married another lady. They didn't marry each other's wives. But anyway, so why, I don't know. But it came to pass that Johnny Parsons and his older sister, Joni, were raised for a number of years living with Dwayne Carter and Arza. And then along came Poncho in 1950, who was Dwayne Carter Jr. And then Dana, I think, was like 1952 or something. So the four of them were raised in the same household in Speedway, Indiana.
The wheel keeps turning where family ties are concerned. Last year, Connor Daly, the son of television analyst Derek Daly and stepson of Indianapolis Motor Speedway president Doug Bowles, became the latest second-generation driver to qualify for the 500 when he drove for another famous family, the Foyts. The next family connection at the 500 could come as early as next year, as Matthew Brabham has progressed to driving Indy Lights for Michael Andretti's team. His grandfather won the Formula One World Championship, and his father was an outstanding road racer who also had two top five finishes in the Indianapolis 500. And the youngest Brabham is quite proud of the legacy.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to be a part of. I can't describe the feeling. And, you know, just I grew up listening to, you know, the family stories, you know, around the dinner table and the amazing experiences, even, you know, off the track, you know, going in between races or what they did, especially my grandfather over in Europe and him coming over here as well. And then having to listen to my dad, you know, talk as well. It's just really cool and it inspires me a lot. And that's pretty much where all my motivation comes from, is just those guys and trying to, you know, make my own way into and kind of follow in their footsteps and get my own story. So it's really special. And I guess it's sometimes I do take it for granted a little bit, because, you know, it's just sometimes I think of my dad as my dad, or, you know, my grandfather as my grandfather. But, you know, at the end of the day, when I really sit back and look at what they did, I'm very proud and honored to be a part of a family such as the Brabhams.
Brabham says he can't wait to add his own chapter to what his family has accomplished at the corner of 16th and Georgetown.
I can't wait, you know, to get that opportunity. But, you know, I think it's going to be really special, obviously. You know, I heard stories of my grandfather going through a massive fireball. And then, you know, my dad's experiences with, you know, race, you know, driving a Penske car compared to driving a really low-end team car, and the differences in that. And it's really interesting to hear that kind of stuff. So I'm really looking forward to it. And I obviously, a couple of years ago, was the first time I'd actually ever seen the event, you know, firsthand. And I was completely blown away. I don't think, you know, as much as those guys talked about it and my family talked about it, it never really sank in. And it's one of those things you can't fully understand until you get there. And now that I'm here and in the States and I've seen the race, that's something I definitely want to do.
Of course, as we close in on the 98th Indianapolis 500, there's one more family to talk about. The Hallman George family has owned the Indianapolis Motor Speedway since November 14th, 1945, when Tony Hallman purchased the track from Eddie Rickenbacker. The Speedway has remained under family control ever since. And last year, the family even led the field to the green flag.
Well, we watched the alignment. It looks pretty good through the first four rows. Now row 5 and 6 off of turn number 4. This is a good-looking alignment, and it looks like the green flag will wave. It's Ed Carpenter. He'll jump to the front early. The rookie Munoz will look to the inside, and Marco Andretti, he'll look to the outside, but Ed Carpenter is the leader in turn number 1.
Ed Carpenter, the stepson of former Speedway president Tony George, won the pole for the 2013 Indianapolis 500. And you can bet it would be a family affair in Victory Lane if Carpenter can cross the yard of bricks first on race day. Thanks for joining us for Heroes of the 500, the Family Ties Edition. I'm Steve Simpson.
The broadcast came to you through the facilities at WIBC Indianapolis.